You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This episode, I'm joined by experiencer and researcher Andy Hardy from the Shadows and Sightings YouTube channel. Andy has had some unusual experiences in his life, but it all seemed to escalate after he joined the British Army, and this exposed him to some extremely odd incidents. During a stint on Dartmoor, Andy and his colleagues had a variety of odd experiences, which he kindly shares with us, as well as his discovery of a lost treasure of Fortean reports hiding in plain sight. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. And once again, thank you to each and every one of you for your support and contributions. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. And our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and you can find the link for that in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines, and thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brian Stoll of the Ghost Story Guys. Now, Andy shares some unsettling and rather unusual experiences with us all. A lifetime punctuated by unusual occurrences had been my guest's experience of the strange, but a sighting whilst on tour with the British Army changed everything for Andy Hardy. Now Andy has decided to share his personal experiences on his new channel, Shadows and Sightings. Andy, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you very much, mate, for having me. And I love the intro. Never had one of them done for me before, so I enjoyed that.
Hey, it's always nice. Always nice. The longer you do it, Andy, the longer it gets, mate. So all power to you, mate.
Yeah, I look forward to it tonight, mate.
Hey, no problems. So as I said, you're a gentleman, like many of us in this particular field, I think, Andy, that sometimes we can grow up and strange things happen to us, or we live in a haunted house, or we see strange things growing up. And depending on the type of family you've got and the unit, usually people are quite... your granddad's a ghost or something else. What was it like for you? Because as I said in the introduction, you had some strange occurrences occur to you throughout your life, but clearly the one that occurred to you, 2013, has kind of really sent you on a real passion, I think, in regards for talking about this particular subject and opening your own sort of interests in a variety of fields.
Yeah, mate, well, I suppose the UFO sighting that I had in 2013 was when I was in Afghanistan. And that kind of made it full circle for me. So before that, I'd seen that. We'll probably get into it, but I seen that devil demon creature when I was four. Mm. And then that kind of got me into the paranormal investigative stuff. And then when I was in the military on Dartmoor, I seen the orbs and I seen shadow men. And some weird cryptid stuff there. And then up until that point, mate, I wasn't really, UFOs, mate, really weren't my thing. Mm. And it wasn't until 2013, like I say, I was in Afghanistan, I saw that UFO over there. That kind of brought me full circle, mate, into looking into everything, pretty much. And then it was off, I was on, just in the chat one night on Paul's channel, Truth Proof, and I was just in the chat and somebody asked a question, generally, and I answered it about something that I saw when I was in the military. Mm-hmm. And then from then, mate, it kind of snowballed and people were saying to me, oh, you know, you should go on Paul's channel, blah, blah, blah. So off the back of that, mate, I jumped on there and I told some of my stories on Paul's channel and my experiences. And I got a pretty good and a lot of good feedback. And then off the back of there, mate, I ended up going down to Bempton mm-hmm. and I had a strange experience there. And then that kind of propelled me on to doing my own channel, especially the people in the chat were saying, oh, Andy, we want to hear more about your stories and that type of stuff. And then, like we were talking in the green room before, that kind of pushed me into decided to be a bit of a researcher and led onto the 2-4 files.
So I suppose often the challenge with this kind of thing is, to all intents and purposes, you might have private conversations with a partner or a loved one, Andy. But when you cross that threshold, speaking from personal experience, and you stop being a partner who's just interested in weird stuff to being the partner that goes out looking for weird stuff, how's that been?
To be fair, mate, the only time my partners came with me to do anything like this was when we went to Bempton.
Mm.
And to be fair, mate, it was good to have her there because of what happened there and the interaction we had. Because there was two people, a lot of stuff that I'd forgot, or not even some stuff I'd forgot, but stuff I'd seen and stuff I'd experienced there, it was nice to have somebody validate it and say, no, that did happen. I was there with you. That definitely happened. This happened. And then also, it gave me a different perspective of what I saw, because what I saw down at the bottom of the cliffs was different to what Leanne saw at the bottom of the cliffs. So, and to be fair, mate, what happened at Bempton, a lot of that was pretty tangible. And it was, you know, it was, I don't want to say real, that's the wrong word, but, you know, it was pretty, in this dimension, should I say, type thing.
Yes.
And it was very much a human interaction, that's a better phrase. The stuff about UFOs and the demon devil thing that I saw and all the stuff I experienced on Dartmoor, I've never really spoke to her about it. It's not really an interest of hers. The only thing we've ever really spoke about is what happened at Bempton, because she was involved in it. So other than that, mate, I'm very much solo wise, really doing research and going out and exploring and things like that.
Yeah, it is a big jump, isn't it? When you have to change your plans and say, oh, I'm not going to the pub Friday night. I'm off to this local UFO hotspot. It must be a bit of a sea change, Andy.
Oh, massively. I mean, it's a good sea change, mate, in terms of I find it exciting, exhilarating. And you know yourself, Paul, the more you do it, you end up with more questions. You very rarely get answers. So you kind of just end up chasing your tail from one thing to another. And I suppose, mate, really, in terms of me being a researcher, I'm probably still within, what, the first year, maybe? Maybe a year and a half, maybe. Yeah. So even though I've had experience since I was, what, 4?
Yeah.
My researching journey, mate, really, is only pretty new, in the infancy, pretty much. The one thing I will say, mate, is, like you say, crossing the threshold and telling people your story and your experiences is a big deal. And of all the things I thought I would get backlash on, not backlash, but I thought I would get a bit ridicule on, was that devil demon thing I saw when I was 4 going on 5.
Mm.
And that mate, has probably been one of my best videos.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show me that you never know what's going to hit, what's going to miss, what you're going to get ridicule on. I think I've been lucky. All the experiences I've had so far have been really positive from people.
Mm. Well, I suppose it's the big challenge. I mean, regardless, Andy, of how long you've been involved in something, I think sometimes it's a challenge to open yourself up sometimes when we're talking about strange things. So as we've kind of touched on, growing up for you grew up in Teesside, up here in the northeast of England.
I did, but yeah, I grew up in a place called Thornaby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I been mean, past it many a there. Time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm a big lover of the northeast. It's a place very close to my heart. I've spent many a day up there, mate, all over the place. I love Northumberland and County Durham. So I'm you're preaching to the converted, as it were, as fellow northerners. We tend to support each other with our beautiful homesteads, my friend. What was your family like then growing up? Because I can imagine when you're sort of 4 or 5, Andy, and you start to have these encounters and you see this particular creature, as you've mentioned, this sort of devilish, demony type thing. What was it like in your family? Were your family, did they have an interest in the supernatural, in the paranormal? Did you have a weird uncle who was always reading dodgy books that your parents were always telling him not to leave lying around near yourself and any other young children? Anything like that? Or was it just, they were just a typical northern working class family with some children growing up and talking about whatever happened?
So I suppose, mate, we definitely were just a normal working class family growing up. And it's, so anyway, yeah, so growing up, mate, I suppose the only thing I would say in terms of the paranormal stuff was my gran on my dad's side was very much at the paranormal. So she was in the local paper having a haunted wardrobe.
Right.
She used to have a Halloween party every year. She used to like telling ghost stories. So my grandma died when I was around about 7 or 8.
Mm.
So I always assume it when this happened, back when I was 4 going on 5, when that happened, I assumed it was to do with my dad's side and my gran. I thought that's where the whole thing come from. It wasn't until I went on to Paul's channel and spoke about that.
Mm.
Then I didn't tell anybody I was on that, mate, Wheely. Like, I didn't tell any of my family. I kept that quiet. And somehow my mum and my family ended up watching it.
Mm.
And then, yes, so off the back of that, my mum then rang me and said, you do realise that how much paranormal activity went on our side as well, like growing up, like it was horrendous. And I was like, what? Because I'd never, ever heard these stories before, growing up or anything. And then she said that where they lived growing up, so there were 7 of them, Paul, there was 4 boys and 3 girls.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that the house they used to live in, all the boys shared one bedroom.
Yeah.
And one of my uncles in particular had it the worst. And he said that this old man used to come out the wardrobe and he used to torment them and torture them on a night time. And mum said she could remember hearing the boys scream in the middle of the night about this old man who'd come out the wardrobe, and then he would sit in the corner and he would poke and prod and try and pull them in bed and stuff. To the point where my uncle who had it the worst used to sleep with the crucifix. That's how bad it got. At one point, so it wasn't until I put myself out there and I spoke about my stories that I then realised both sides of my family were on the paranormal route, for want of a better phrase. Mm. But growing up, Paul, I didn't know any of that. From my mum's side, that was very, and maybe because we were raised Catholic. It was a big Catholic family. Maybe that wasn't something that was spoken about, you know. And when I saw that devil demon creature thing, that was, so when we lived in that house, my mum, my dad, and my sister lived in it before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anything really happened. I think mum said one time she woke up because she could feel a pressure on her leg. And when she woke up, there was an old lady sat on the end of the bed, sat on the bottom of her legs, and she was crying, and it was a ghost. And she said she just started saying the Lord's Prayer and the Hail Mary, and this ghost went away. That was the only thing she ever said happened in that house. And my dad and my sister never had anything happen to them. But yeah, so when I was 4, Paul, so I remember being terrified of the dark, petrified of the dark. So they used to leave, my bedroom door was always wide open, and they'd leave the lantern light on for me.
Yes.
So as you came out my bedroom door, you would turn right, and then the bathroom door was in front of me on the landing. And then there was a little alcove where we used to keep the washing basket. I've went out in the middle of the night to go to the toilet. And as I've walked down to go to the toilet, out of that little alcove where the washing basket was, this figure stepped out. Must have been about 7 foot tall, burnt orange red colour.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, if you ever take the clothes off an action man, you know how the body's smooth.
Yes.
That's what his body was like, but he was massive, like bodybuilder type build.
Mm.
Pure black eyes, sharp pointy teeth, and he had horns. But you know, maybe an inch and a half, 2 inches big when you get a bull, and it's a young bull, and they're just starting to fall.
Yes.
That type of thing, mate. Yeah. So that's what he looked like. And when I see him, and I'm stood there, and I've always said he must have been about 7 foot tall, Paul, because my sister must be close to 6 foot, and that's always how I've gauged. And he was a lot taller than my sister.
Yeah.
So that's how I've always gauged him. And obviously I'm stood there frozen, petrified. And then he kind of had like a sinister smile and a chuckle, like he made a noise. And then he reached out to grab me, like put his arm out to grab me. And then at that point, I've came out of the trance or being frozen or scared or whatever. And then I've spun, and then I've ran into my mum and dad's bedroom, which was directly behind me. And then once I've got in there, I'm hysterical. And when they managed to calm me down, I kept saying, I've seen the devil, I've seen the devil. And I could never remember which parent it was, but it turns out it was my dad, thanks to my sister. My sister told me a couple of days ago. So my dad turned around to my mum and said, how does he know what the devil is? And at that time, it being far, I would have known what the devil was. I wouldn't have known. Even though I was raised Catholic, mate, that was never said to me. I had no concept of it. And then, like I say, mate, wasn't too much longer after that, we moved. And then we moved to the house my mum and dad are still in now. So that's what kind of, so that mate in itself was what propelled me into this world of phenomena type thing.
Yeah. Well, like you say, I think it would be very easy to kind of dismiss it and say, oh, well, you know, he was brought up Catholic, so clearly he must have known about it. But I think most of us have known people whose parents were religious growing up, and they probably not so much these days, but certainly, you know, through the 70s and 80s and early 90s, you would still have some families that were quite religious in that regard. Mm. It's not the kind of thing that kids are told about, you know, after they come home from nursery, is it? You know, let's sit down, we'll do in a bit of Bible.
No, definitely not. No.
You know, they just follow the practices more than anything, or how they live their life or whatever. They don't sort of, you know, try and instill in you a deep fear of religion. And so it's one of those weird catalysts that you'll sometimes get in people's lives when they're growing up, where something completely unusual occurs in their house that seems to be out of the ordinary, but doesn't seem to be connected with other strange things that might be happening. So, I mean, for you and your family, was there anybody else that ever had a weird sighting? I mean, obviously, sometimes you can have multiple family members in the same property seeing things, but they're not necessarily the same thing, which often gives credence to sometimes the thoughts that perhaps whatever entity these things are is presenting itself in whatever would scare you. I mean, to be fair, most four-year-olds, if they stumble across a tall 7-foot red man with horns on his head and spiky teeth, it's going to frighten you whether you know what the devil is or not, Andy.
Yeah, true, mate. Very true. I mean, nobody ever, I never had any, and I've asked my mum, my dad, my sister, mate, and nobody had anything happen to them in that house. And then once we moved to where my mum and dad still live now, nothing ever happened to me in that house, ever. That was kind of, like I say, the catalyst for me to go down the journey with the paranormal and the phenomena and that type of thing. But nothing happened to me, mate, until I went in the army, weirdly. Nothing, like I literally had a block of what, 15 years of nothing. I mean, I was interested in it. I watched, you know, all the ghost programs, cryptid things. I was into the subject, but nothing really happened to me, Paul, ever, up until I joined the military. The only thing I can remember is my family used to have to go to church every Sunday up until we were 16. That was the rule. Yeah. And once you were 16, you didn't have to go anymore if you didn't want to. And I can remember, because I'm one of the youngest, all my cousins by then, mate, weren't at church because obviously they decided, oh, we don't want to do this. And I can remember, mate, one time one of my cousins came to church randomly out the blue, and he was a lot older than me. And I can remember saying to my mum in church, I would have been about 14, 15, mate, then. I said, what's he doing back? And my mum I don't know what he's doing here type thing. I spoke to him outside because he'd asked to speak to me. And he said to me, oh, can I talk to you? And I was like, yeah, of course you can. And I could see him starting to get a bit teary and anxious. And I don't know why I said it, but I said, you've seen him, haven't you? And he went, I need to know what you saw when you were a little kid. And I was like, so I told him. And that's when he said, mate, he'd saw the same thing. But then, mate, he would have been in his early 20s then. And he said he'd saw that same thing in where he was living. And then from then, mate, I think he still goes to church now. That made him go back. And I think he's been going to church, mate, ever since. So that's the only time, mate, that story I've ever came up again. Nobody asked me about it. We never spoke about it. It wasn't until, like I say, he asked me that when I was maybe 14, 15.
I suppose as well, your brain automatically begins to think, well, if I've seen it and my cousin's seen it, is there anybody else in my family that have seen this? Because I presume, Andy, that this obviously wasn't in the same property you had your encounter.
No, mate, it wasn't. No, somewhere totally different, yeah.
So basically, we've got two members of the same extended family seeing the same thing, what, 15 years apart, 10 years apart, in completely different properties.
10 years apart, yeah. Yeah, totally different properties. The only, like you say, mate, the two common denominators are, obviously, it was extended family on my mum's side, and it was in Thornaby. It was still in Thornaby.
Yeah.
Like you say, those are the two only common denominators with it.
Mm. So did he see, as you said, it was in his house. Did he kind of say, was it on his upstairs landing? Was it downstairs? Andy, did he give you any sort of...
No, he didn't, mate. He did not want to talk about it whatsoever.
Mm.
The only thing that he said to me was that he'd saw the exact same thing to what I'd seen. And then when I tried to talk to him about it and I say to him, where did you see it? Did he speak? What did they do? He was just like, nah, that's it. That's all I need to know. And he just walked off. And he didn't want to talk about it. So that mate is the only time it's ever read itself. But like I say, I originally thought it was my dad's side that this weird stuff was on. And then it transpires that more weird stuff and more connection is more on my mum's side.
Yeah. So I suppose, as you refer to there, Andy, you always maintain an interest. I think this is the thing about this. Once you get the bug, you kind of just let it churn over. I was very much the same. I read a lot, watched the programmes, and then kind of fell away from it. In my 20s, I think some of us do when you do, and then you kind of come back to it when you get to a point where you think, I don't care anymore. I'm going to enjoy these things a bit more now. And so joining the army, was that... I mean, when you look back, do you think that was the catalyst to kind of make you more open-minded in regards to this? Because often you will find yourself pushing yourself physically and mentally, Andy, depending on which regiment you are and where you're stationed and what you've got to do around the world. I know, as you've mentioned, and I'm sure we'll touch on it, you've been on tour in Afghanistan. You know, you get to see some things that the average person never can even sort of imagine, I think. I think most people have an idea about the field of conflict or going on tour in certain locations around the world. But unless you've got your boots on the ground and you've either got a family member who's been a squaddie or in the armed forces, or you yourself have had some experience of it, what you think it is and the reality are very different things. So for you, how quickly did it sort of start to manifest that weird stuff started to happen? Because I have to say, I love strange stories from the armed forces. There's a brilliant series of books that I've recently discovered called Ghost Stations, which is a whole collection of paranormal encounters based on British RAF bases. And I didn't even know they existed till about a year ago, Andy. So I'm trying to track down, because there's about 12 of them. And they're all full of first-person accounts from the RAF of different weird things, people in planes and peoples and stuff. So I'll send you some links to that afterwards and you can have a look.
That's very interesting,
that might be right up your wheelhouse, because there's some fascinatingly strange stories. Was it something that your comrades talked about? Did you have one of those kind of regiments where you'd have, when you were having a bit of chill out time, you'd sit around, have a few beers and share strange stories?
So the only time, mate, that I ever really spoke about anything was when the sightings or the encounters actually happened in Dartmoor. So when things actually happened, I spoke to the lads about it, and I would say pretty much in the terms we would use, like a hot debrief, like literally after it happened, we would discuss it straight away. And then, mate, like a lot of things when you're military, because it's that fast paced, or it was back then because it was very much Afghan focused.
Yes.
Something would happen and you would talk about it for maybe an hour, and you'd do like a real debrief on it, because it just happened to not just me, to all of us.
Yes.
But then the next, within that, once you'd spoke about it, mate, the next thing was, well, now's the next serial. Now's the next exercise. Now's the next pre-deployment trip. Now's the next something else. So before you know it, mate, that incident that was quite profound, integral, before you know it, mate, you're 4 weeks down the line and you've been on exercise. And that one instance, mate, is kind of forgotten about. Mm. It's not until you get a bit of downtime where you can then say, this happened, that happened. I mean, I will say, mate, I never spoke about anything that happened to me on Dartmoor once I left.
Mm.
I kept that to myself pretty much, mate, until I started my own channel or I went on Paul's. I never really spoke with any about that apart from the lads who witnessed it until I'd left, purely because, to be fair, mate, that the UFO I saw in Afghan, I think, is the most logical thing that I've ever seen. Mm. It's the most grounded sighting or encounter I've had. I think a lot of people can get their heads around that. All the other stuff I've seen has been very much out there, and I think it takes a lot more of a believer or someone who's entrenched in the phenomena to really get the teeth behind and get the teeth around. With saying that, mate, on Dartmoor, everybody knew that I was, I will say it, everyone knew I was the weird guy. So like when we would come, you know, when we would come off Dartmoor, I can remember at the time when all this happened, mate, the book I was reading was The Mothman Prophecies by John Gale. That's what I was reading at the time. And then I would be watching like paranormal DVDs or ghost stories. Or, you know, so the lads knew, mate, what I was into. And so the whole thing with Dartmoor, mate, kind of kicked off really in essence with that runner who went missing.
Yes.
So that runner, mate, went missing and we were getting ready and it was moving from autumn to winter. And the weather on Dartmoor anyway, mate, all day, every day, it's pretty rubbish. It's never really good. But especially come that time of the year, mate, it was getting pretty bad. Mm. And because we're out there all day, every day, the search and rescue were like, can you lads help? Because we've got a better chance of locating him, especially because there would have been how many of us?
Yeah.
There would have been low 20s, Paul, so 20, 22 of us maybe.
Yeah.
So that massively bolstered the search and rescue guys' numbers.
So were you guys just out there on manoeuvres then, Andy? Were you just doing a training camp, exercises, and that's why you were down there?
Yeah, so at the time, mate, I was doing the beat-up course to then go and do the all-arms commando course down at Limson. So where we were based, mate, is also where the 30-miler starts, which is one of the Royal Marines commando tests.
So
we were based at Oakhampton Camp, and we were there, mate, for... I must have been there for 10 months, close to a year, training and doing the beating for the course. So we were getting ready to go out, mate, on that. I'll never forget, it was on a Saturday. We were getting ready to go out down to Exeter because it was one of the lads' birthdays and we had the weekend off. And that's when the training sergeant came in and said, look, lads, there's a runner missing on the moor. Search and rescue here. They want us to help. Blah, 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 what I've just said. So he said, get your uniform on, get your patrol order, and we'll go out in twos and we'll go to different points. Try and find him. And I must have been out, mate, an hour and a half maybe. Comes over the radio. Look, guys, we've two of the lads have found him, so just make your way back to the camp. So heads back to camp, mate, and as we get to the so we're all in the barracks rooms and I'm getting changed because then we're going to get ready to go back out Wexeter. Job's done. So as we're getting changed, the two lads who'd found him came in after us because obviously they took him down to the ambulance. And as I'm getting changed, one of them said, Andy, you need to run down to that car park, mate, and talk to that guy we've just found. And I said, why would I want to talk to him? I'm getting ready to go out. And they were like, that guy has just said that so he broke his ankle and he couldn't move. And the lads are like, he's told us that this big hairy man found him and he's covered him in mud and moss and leaves to keep him safe until help arrives. And I was like, you are on the wind up. And they were like, hand on heart, mate, not wind you up. That is what he's told us as we found him. So I've took off, mate, running in my shorts down to the car park where the ambulance was. And as I've got there, mate, the ambulance is away. Down the main road, and it's taken him to hospital, like I presume. Yeah. So anyway, mate, I went back to the barracks, and I said, "What did he say to you? You need to tell me now, because I can't speak to the guy." And they said they were down Culliver steps, and they've stopped for a drink of water. one of the lads' mate has dropped his water bottle and it's rolled a little bit down to, close to the stream. And it stopped, it's hit something and stopped. And when he's picked it up, he's then touched the foot of the man. And he said to the lad he was with, he's like, holy shit, the guy's here. So they've scraped all the moss bit and the leaves and the mud off him, and they found him. And I said to him, you didn't see him? And they were like, mate, they were like, that was the best camouflage concealment job we've ever seen. He said, if I hadn't dropped my water bottle, that man would have still been there now. Wouldn't have seen him, didn't hear him, no nothing. It was purely by luck that the water bottle dropped. And that's how they managed to find him. And so that whole incident, mate, kind of kicked off kick-started the weirdness that was Dartmoor.
Well, I mean, that's just crazy, isn't it? Because you would suggest that kind of assistance would be perfect for the situation he found himself in.
Mm.
Because people might think, well, what's he done that for? Clearly, he was trying to insulate him and keep him warm and safe until other people came.
Yeah.
And he probably wouldn't have been able to think about that. And I mean, anybody who's, you know, I had a friend many years ago who went for a run on an icy day and broke a leg. I mean, and she was shitting herself because she was in the middle of the Peak District, Andy. And it was like January.
Yeah.
Who's going to be wondering? Only nutters. And luckily, she was found after about 50 minutes by a guy randomly walking his dog. But she said, if he hadn't found me, God knows what would have happened.
Yeah, would have been bad news, yeah.
And like you say, places like Dartmoor, it isn't the kind of place you want to get lost. And it's always had a history of people disappearing, climbers, hikers, walkers, wherever. Strange things happen on Dartmoor in general. But most people would suggest it's due to seeing strange large cats or strange lights in the skies above Dartmoor. The fact that you've got some kind of hairy creature going around giving people triage, essentially, Andy, is remarkable, really.
Yeah, it is, mate, yeah.
It's almost as if whatever it was, I mean, people will say, oh, was it Bigfoot? Some people will say, was it the Green Man? Others will suggest perhaps it was some kind of elemental that was coming to protect its area and wanted to make sure this guy was okay. It's frustrating because you were that close to having a first-hand account. But he's gone. He's in the back of the ambulance.
Yeah, he's gone. I mean,
I've never heard of anything similar to that anywhere. Of somebody, not even in some of the Bigfoot accounts in the US, have I heard of anybody being sort of patched up and left for recovery by Bigfoot. But then I suppose you also have to look at the strangeness of your comrade dropping his bottle.
Yeah.
Why did that happen where it happened? Because if it hadn't happened, he would never have seen him. So what was that always going to happen? And if so, what kind of condition was the guy in when they found him? How long had he been missing, Andy?
So he'd been this is the crazier part of the story. So he'd actually been missing, mate. I believe, if memory serves, he'd been missing all night, which is why we were then looking for him. So he went out during the day before, which would have been the Friday. Mm. He'd went out after work, obviously went down, broke his ankle. He was then there overnight, and it was the next morning, maybe about 11 o'clock-ish, when we set off to look for him. If memory serves, so the lads would have found him about 12:30, like midday the next day. So he'd been out, mate, for 17 hours?
Yeah.
He'd been out there. And in that weather, if he wasn't covered up, he would have been a goner, mate, or he definitely would have been, like, severely hypothermic, I would imagine.
Oh, yes.
If he hadn't have been covered up. But like, so when that happened, Paul, I'd never ever heard of a British Bigfoot or a Green Man. I'd never heard of anything like that. So when that got told to me, instantly, I thought Bigfoot, but then I started to think. I'm thinking all day. Then I was like, "What on earth was it that did that?" Because we don't have Bigfoot, or we don't like I said, I didn't know anything about Green Man. I didn't know anything about that, and I was thinking about maybe solid for a month whilst I was up there. Mm. What is it? And I'm racking my brain, mate. And then, like I say, like most things, exercise comes. Then the next training piece comes, the next serial. And before you know, mate, I forget about it up until all the other weird stuff starts happening to us on Dartmoor. The only segue to that, mate, is that as I was leaving there, like I said, I'd been there about 10 months and I hadn't even heard about the big cats on Dartmoor, really. Paul either. I'd heard about the Beast of Bodmin and Exmoor and that type of thing, but I'd never heard of anything on Dartmoor. And it wasn't until I was leaving and we were packing up all our kit to leave to then go up to Limston. And a couple of the older guys came in, who at that point would have been maybe at the 20-year point, so they'd been in, this was, 2010, so they'd been in since 1990. And as they're coming, they were just chatting to us and kind of seeing us off, good luck, lads, hope you pass, that type of thing. Yeah. And they overheard me talking to one of the other guys about this hairy man story. And the lad I was talking to was like, why are you still bothered about that? Like, let it go. It's just a crazy story. And I was like, how are you not yes. fascinated by this? But anyway, so as I'm saying this, a couple of these older guys said to us all, what are you talking about? So I told them. And they said, back in the early 90s, we were tasked up here. And we spent a couple of months here purely out on the moor looking for big cats.
Yeah.
So they'd been tasked by the MOD to actually set up there to try and find these big cats. And I said to them, did you ever catch one or anything? He said, no. He said, we saw a couple of them. We saw a couple of things over there. I think there were different people there over a course of maybe 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
They would move in, move out. And he said there was maybe 2 or 3 sightings over the 3 years of different groups that had seen them. But he said they'd never managed to catch one. Or anything like that. So that, and then the frustrating thing about that is, Paul, that was at the end of my time. If I'd have known that at the 10 months when I first went, I would have had 10 months to look out for something. But the nature of what it was, I didn't find that out until the end.
Absolutely. It seems like Dartmoor kept giving you the crumbs just as you were off.
To be fair, mate, it didn't. I had a big chunk maybe the final 3 months, the final third. When I was there, and that was the last chunk, maybe happened constantly, really, for maybe three weeks.
Yeah.
So that started off with seeing the Shadow Man.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened, it was, we were out in exercise on Dartmoor, and if you've ever been to Dartmoor, mate, if people have never been, it's a very, very open moor. There's very, very little woodland. There's the odd tree block here and there, but for the most of it, it's a pretty much wide open area.
Yes.
And so where we would set up would literally just be on the moor, and you pretty much have 360 views of everything. And when you go up there, mate, you will have the odd big boulder that's planted. You'll have a tor, you'll have a big boulder, you'll have some rocky outcrops. And where we happen to set up, where our stag point was, directly in front of it, maybe 150 meters away, was this big boulder. And what the way stag would work was, it was a 2-hour slot, and say you run from 2 till 4 at 3 o'clock in the morning, your partner would leave, a new guy would come in, and then when you left at 4, he'd already been an hour. So at every given point, someone had been on for an hour.
Yes.
So at least someone had night vision type thing as it went on. So this night, and I was section commander, so you didn't have to do stag. But every now and again, I used to do a section of stag just to give lads some extra rest. So this night, I've jumped out and I've said to the lads, look, you get your head down, I'll do your stag, and then I'll just get the next guy who was meant to be on. Like, oh, nice, Andy. So anyway, mate, I'm laid down on the stag point. And usually, mate, when it's the early hours of the morning and it's dead quiet, and you're tired, you're feeling it, you'll just have a bit of crack with each other, keep each other going, whisper, a bit of banter type thing. And I've been laid down with it for about half an hour. And the guy next to me is not saying anything at all, like quiet as a mouse. So I've said to him, I've nudged him. And he's like, yeah. I was like, you all right? And he's like, yeah, I'm fine. He's like, there's someone behind that big boulder there. I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, I've been watching him for the past hour. There's a guy. And I was like, what, like one of the DS directing staff? And he's like, nah. And I was like, how do you know it's not one of the directing staff? And he was like, have a look at that big, have a look at the boulder on the left-hand side. And he's like, you'll see something step out. So I'm like, right, okay. So I'm there like this, looking at this big boulder. And I'm thinking, he's just tired. He's just shattered. Yeah. He can't, he's just seeing things. And then as I'm about to look away, this shadow figure steps out from behind this boulder, and it was a full moon, so you had really good optics of how to see him.
Yeah.
And he was the texture of always said polish, you know, like when someone has a wetsuit on.
Yes, it's like oily.
It was that type of texture, and it seemed to be sucking all the light in. That's what it seemed to be doing.
Yeah.
And it was darker than the night. Like, so the black was a distinct black. You could tell it was different. He had me on his head either a set of horns or a top hat. The people who so there was maybe four or five of us who saw it, and it differs me who saw it. Apparently, some think he had a set of horns, some think he had a top hat on.
Mm.
Depending on who saw it, that seems the two distinct routes. And that's what he looked like. And obviously when you're in the military, mate, you'd have, if it was DS, they would have Bergen, Webbing, it would be blocky. You know, you've got a certain shape of what you look like when you're in the military. And like I say, mate, he had nothing on him. He was totally smooth. It was just like a human figure. Like I say, when I saw it, I had the top hat on. And so when he said it's definitely not the DS, I know what he meant.
Yes.
Because there was no way on this planet. It was the DS figure. Now, and loads of people have said to me with that story, but why didn't you go beyond the boulder and see what it was? And I was like, if you put yourself in our shoes, there was 24 lads out on the field then.
Yeah.
We had weapons. Mm-hmm. We were fit. We were robust. I said, what type of nutter goes out there in a wetsuit with a top hat, hiding behind a boulder? Who would do it?
Mm.
I said, it was scary. Like, the lads who saw that were genuinely terrified of it. Like, it wasn't a good feeling to see it. And not one single person out the four or five who saw it ever said, let's go beyond that boulder and see who it was.
Mm.
Not a single person, because you knew instinctively that whatever was beyond that boulder wasn't good. And also, if we did go beyond the boulder, mate, we caught whatever it was, what do we do with it?
Mm.
Because then we've caught someone. It was just a no-win situation, that situation. The overriding feeling was that we were scared. There was something instinctive that said, do not go over there and tackle whatever this thing was. So that was, and so there was, like I said, there was maybe four or five people who saw that. That wasn't just me.
I mean, it's, like you say, it's one of them things, Andy, because people will say, oh, well, it was just somebody trying to pull your leg. I'm not really sure why you would decide to have a bit of fun with a group of guys with semi-automatic weapons on them who probably have a strict sense of orders. Obviously, we don't have shoot to kill here, but depending on certain circumstances, or, you know, if you offer the challenge and there's no response or somebody's acting suspicious, there are channels and levels you have to take the situation.
Yeah.
Often you will always try and de-escalate it as much as you can. However, on occasion, things...
Yeah,
you can't. Doesn't matter what you do; it's never going to de-escalate it. Sadly, but the chances of somebody taking that risk on one of the most barren, desolate, dangerous places in the United Kingdom, without a shadow of a doubt, Dartmoor. There's bogs, there's swamps, there's quicksand, there's falling rocks. Yeah. There's things you're not aware of, unless even locals around there can sometimes get caught out by how quick the weather can change as well, Andy. It's a dangerous place to be mucking about at the best of times. Never mind trying to pull one over a group of lads from the army. Never mind anything else. But for you all to get that instinctive kind of gut feeling of not wanting to go over and not wanting to see what it could possibly be is an interesting thing. As well as that, like you've described it, because I've heard other people in other parts of the world talk about encountering these shadow people, shadow men, hat man, whatever they want to call it. And some of them will come across and they will explain that description like you've just given there, where it seems blacker than the night or the darkest black you've ever seen. And it almost looks like it's wet or oily or there's like it's oozing or it's... There's something about it. It's hard to describe. I think one of the best descriptions I ever heard, there's a film called Return of the Living Dead from the 1980s, Andy.
Yeah.
And one of the zombies in there is famously known as the Tar Man, because essentially he's basically melting. And I heard one person said, the best way I can describe what he looked like was the Tar Man from Return of the Living Dead, that kind of shiny black ooziness about them.
That's a good description.
And so that's always quite striking as well, because when you're, I mean, this is the other thing, when you're on Dartmoor, you have moonlight as your main source of illumination.
Yeah.
But it's black. I'm surprised sometimes when you pull people out of the cities, or, you know, they've never been to these places. Like, you know, we've got some of these wonderful locations in the UK where if you catch it at the right time, or you go somewhere, it is incredible. It's beautifully desolate, Andy. It's fabulous.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah. That must have been challenging, because you then begin to think, you know, like we were saying, Dartmoor's got so many stories about all kinds. Like you said, we've mentioned the big cats. There's ghosts galore there. One of my favourite British ghost stories is from Dartmoor, which is the Hairy Hands story from about 100 years ago. I love that story. Terrified me the first time I read about it, in a caravan. Andy sleeping under a big window as an 8-year-old on a windy night. And I've just read this story about spit hairy hands where it attacks somebody in a caravan, banging on the window. Yeah. And I'm linking. Brilliant. Really good. What a great idea to read that story, Paul. So, it like you say, you've gone through everything. You're thinking, oh, well, maybe this lad's a bit tired. He's seeing things. He's run down. He's exhausted. But for then you to see it, and then somebody else to see it, and so on and so forth, straight away you start thinking, well, this isn't tiredness. This isn't stuff. And for it's not like you're looking at something, and as with anything, Andy, your brain will always try and put a face on something or try and create shapes, and you can stare at things and eventually you begin to trick yourself. But that's when you're just staring at something that's not moving. When it physically moves around something to kind of go, hello, I'm here, and let you see it and then go back, you know you're not hallucinating at this point. And also, two people don't hallucinate the same thing.
And so, obviously, because he'd been there mate, an hour before me, once the hour's up, he then leaves me to go get the other guy to replace him. So obviously, mate, there's like a 5-minute gap where I'm just there by myself, and I'm staring at the boulder, and I can still see it, but I'm thinking at this point, please do not like come towards me out the boulder. That's all I wanted. I thought if you stay there, I'm quite happy with you being that far away. But so when the new guy arrived, I thought to myself, I'm not going to say anything at all to him about what I can see, because one, I didn't want to freak him out. And then also I thought, if he now turns around and says to me, can you see something? I then know it's not me putting the thing in his head.
Yes.
So again, mate, we're there for about half an hour and I'm still got my eyes fixed on it.
Yeah.
And around about the half an hour mark, I remember looking at my watch and thinking, oh, thank God, I've only got half an hour left and I can get away from this. But that's all I could think. And then at that point, the new lad had said to me, Andy, is there someone behind that boulder? And my skin ran cold, and I thought, there's definitely something there now, because now you've got the third person who hasn't heard anything about it, who's now seeing it, and so then yes, obviously he saw it, and then the two people after me saw it, and I think if memory serves me, it died off at maybe around about 5 o'clock. Mm. That's when they stopped seeing it. But I mean, even when I left, mate, and went back to my, like, you know, my bash or my sleeping bag, I didn't sleep all night because after you saw it, I'm just sat there thinking, listening to me for any tiny little thing. Do you know what I mean? Trying to listen out for the lads on stag. Are they all right? And I'm my brain, mate, has gone a million miles an hour. So that mate was that happened on the first night we were out as well. So maybe mate, if it was day, 20 of a 21-day exercise, maybe I would have said the lads are knackered. But with it being day one, night one, the lads were pretty fresh. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And like I said, there was four or five lads who saw it. And that's when the next day, I got them to come to my bash, because I was section commander. And I said, look, lads, no judgment here. I saw it. This is what I saw. What did you see? And that's when everyone said the same, but there was a difference in opinion of whether he had a top hat or whether he had a set of horns. It was probably 60-40, top hat or horns. Three of us thought it was a top hat, two thought it was a set of horns. And that, mate, set the weird sequence of events off that led into seeing the weird orbs of lights.
Yeah.
That led into that weird bubble of anxiety or fear or I don't know what that was. And that's what kind of led into that whole 3 week exercise moment where the weird stuff was happening.
So did it seem to be escalating, Andy? Did it seem to be getting stranger?
I would say, mate, really, I suppose maybe you could say that happened and then things definitely escalated and ramped up and a lot more stuff happened. For me, it was kind of the opposite way around.
Mm.
For maybe scariness, because obviously that Shadow Man was the scariest thing.
Yeah.
And then seeing the orbs of light and stuff, it kind of tapered off in scariness. Seeing the orbs of lights were kind of more fascinating, intriguing. Mm. You would want to see what they were. And you would see them pretty much every night, mate, if not every other night.
Yeah.
You would see, and there were never colours, mate, that we would use. So we would always use red light.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was one of the DS, would always use white light because they're not under the same conditions we were, and they were just looking for us type thing.
Yeah.
So was he always ever going to be white light or red light? And the ones you would always see, mate, were green, blue, purple. Never anything that we would use, which was the odd thing. And you would see them, mate, go like in and out of, you know, the tors or the crags. You would see them go in and out of the baby sheds, that type of thing. And then just like that appeared, they would just go. And to be fair, mate, lads were a lot more willing to talk about that. Because like I say, that's not that hard to get your head around, I suppose.
Yeah.
And when lads would talk about it, that one's quite easy to rationalise off. You know, lads would say, oh, well, it's just a glow stick. Or it's someone with a green filter on instead of a red, you know what I mean? That was always quite easy to bat off.
Yeah.
I think that's why lads are more willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then the last thing that happened on there, mate, was we were set up close to a wood block, but not in the wood block, one of the very few on Dartmoor. And it would have been early hours of the morning. And the only time, mate, I've ever seen a red orb as opposed to one of the other colours.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see it going in and out of the trees in the wood block.
Yeah.
And then I could hear voices. I couldn't make out what they were saying, but you know when you can hear two people talking, or a couple of people, and you can't hear what they're saying, but you know there's people talking. And it was early hours of the morning, mate, and I'm fuming, because we're getting towards the end of the exercise, and I'm thinking, if we get caught now, and we fill exercise for these idiots in this wood block, I'm going to be fuming. So I've got out my sleeping bag, mate, and I've stormed over to this wood block. And as I'm going to the woodblock, and I can still see the red light at this point, so I'm storming over, and as I get there, the red light goes out, and the voice has stopped. And then at that point, mate, I'm pretty peeved off. So I'm like, I know he's here, I've heard you, I've saw the red light, get back to the harbour area, go to sleep, do whatever you're doing, do your night routine. I don't want to see you again in here. So as I've said it, I'm waiting to hear them talk or to hear them walking, and nobody's moving. So then I'm saying, look, guys, just go back to the harbour area and it's done with. Like, I'm not going to bollock you. Just go back. Just end it. And nobody's moving. So I'm like, well, they have to go somewhere. They can't just disappear. So I'm walking about, mate, in this... So at this point, mate, I'm walking about in this woodblock trying to... Not find them per se, but trying to push them into moving so I can at least hear where they are. And I could hear, mate, nothing. And I thought, well, because it was hard to judge distance, mate, in that woodblock, I thought, well, potentially maybe they were on the tree line.
Yeah.
As soon as I've shouted at them, they've then made it onto the moor, and you're not really going to hear them then. So I thought maybe they haven't started to make it back. So as I'm walking out of the woodblock trying to go back to the harbour area, there is a... I walk into... I couldn't see anything, but I walked into a... It felt like, you know, like walking into a swimming pool. Like,
yes.
It felt like walking into liquid. But I couldn't see anything. And it was maybe 10, 20 metres long, this bubble. And I've never suffered from anxiety, Paul, or anything like that, but that's what I assume the feeling is. And I was petrified. And I've took off running at full tick to get out. And as I've... as I've, like I say, I ran between 10 and 20 metres, and I can physically feel myself come out the other side of it.
Yeah.
And as soon as I came out the other side, I felt normal.
Yeah.
Didn't want to run anymore. Wasn't scared. Didn't have anxiety. So then I've stopped and I'm like, what on earth has happened here? So then I've turned round and I've walked back towards the bubble that I can't see, but I could physically put my hand in and out and I could get the feeling. And you could feel the difference in the in the bubble of whatever it was. I couldn't see anything, but the bubble was physically there. I just couldn't see anything. And a couple of lads witnessed that, went and got a couple of lads who thought it was crazy at the time for dragging them out of bed in the middle of the hours of the morning. But I needed someone to come with me to make sure that I wasn't losing my mind. And that mate was pretty much tailing off to the end of the exercise. And that was pretty much apart from the shadow man, that's probably the strangest thing that happened when we were there.
Yeah.
Because that was something tangible.
Yeah.
And the more I've thought about it, and I've spoken about, like I say, on Paul's channel and stuff, and somebody said that, do you think maybe it was a military test on something, some type of weapon? And I'd never thought about that before, mate, to be honest with you. It very, very well could have been, if it was some type of, I don't know, some type of infrasound weapon they were trying out, or...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Potentially, it could have been. It's a very good theory. I don't know what that would be, but yeah, that's one of the theories, mate, they got throughout, which could be.
I suppose as well, that would be quite surprising, especially as you were saying earlier, you were reading the Mothman prophecies, because one of the things that Keel stumbles across are these bubbles of fear that you can walk in and out of, Andy. And I've heard people before talk about that. And like you say, some people might put forward that it's some kind of military test. But firstly, it's very localised. It seems to be quite random. You know, we know the military have done tests on their own troops all over the world. It's not just the British Army, you know. I mean, we're a long way from sending guys to the South Pacific to watch nuclear bombs get dropped. Andy, and then think, what's the worst that could happen here? You know? Well, we found out. So, it's not unheard of for things to have been done in that manner. And you would often try and look at the psychological and physical responses that service people would have in certain situations. You want to see how people react under certain stresses and situations. But for that to be that would be... For me, it would probably be more unusual than something quite strange, personally, because why there? Why then? Why when nobody's there? You would do it where there would be probably more test subjects, no?
Yeah, true, mate. And when the person suggested that, I suppose anything's possible, mate, isn't it? The only thing, so later when I went back and I was thinking about it, I thought the only reason, mate, why I don't think it was that was because we were there, mate, for, like I say, 10 months, we knew everybody, every single person, mate, who came in and out of that area because we were there that long. For somebody to try and sneak into that area and set that kind of equipment up, personally, I don't think it would have been possible because you had 20, what, 8, 16, 24, you had 24 lads who were all switched on with the ultimate goal to pass the all-arms commando course. We were all ready and trying to catch out the DS who were trying to get to us. So for somebody to get in there and not make a single noise, not make any type of light discipline issue, to set a weapon or some type of vehicle or instrument up without us knowing, I don't see it, mate, personally. I don't think it could have been done.
No. Just because you can sometimes have a tangible, rational explanation doesn't mean it's right. Just means that it can be put forward. I suppose it's one of those things because I think often even when we're interested in weird things, it's only when you actually go to some of these locations you understand just how strange they are, and Dartmoor is steeped in it.
Yeah.
So I suppose it kind of put you on a good footing in that regards, because from that point on, you would probably then be a bit more switched on, I would imagine. And when you're going to on tour or other locations? Because I know, as we touched at the beginning, you had this incredible sighting in Afghanistan in 2013, which is intriguing for me because I think for anybody who understands or is interested in high strangeness, as soon as you mention strangeness in Afghanistan, a lot of people will think of the famous Operation Post Rock, the stories that have surrounded this alleged base in Afghanistan, which used to be a Mujahideen stronghold, was then was attacked by the Russians who killed everybody. Then the Taliban took it back. They executed all the Russians that were there. Then we took it back. And so you had the Brits and the Aussies and the Americans there. And people were saying there was just something really strange going on there. But it seemed that that wasn't the only thing that was going on. There were lots of strange things happening to certain people, yourself included, because I've seen numerous people from, I've seen members of the Australian forces, the New Zealand forces, Canadian forces, Americans, our guys. They kept seeing strange things in the sky that just didn't make sense. And they were saying, well, we've got rockets coming over all the time. We see bombers, we see flares, we see drones. We know what's going on here. And we keep seeing stuff that nobody knows what's going on.
It's such a strange country, mate. Purely, and when you first go there, obviously, like you just said, mate, you know the history. Constantly been at war for hundreds of years. Mm. So naturally, mate, you've got all the trauma and the history that's seeped into the land anyway.
Yes. But
I can remember going there, and so when you first fly in, mate, I think I spent maybe 7 days at Camp Bastion.
Yes.
And that was kind of just for like acclimatization. You go on the odd run, do all your admin, collect all your kit, that type of stuff. And some of the locals, mate, local Afghan people, had shops inside there, so you could get like your kit tailored, and they would sell stuff and local Afghan things like trinkets and stuff that you might want to take back, towels and things.
Yeah.
And when I got there, mate, I needed something tailored. I want to say, mate, off the top of my head, when I got issued my jungle hat, when you get it issued, it's like one of those massive sombreros.
Yeah.
looks absolutely horrendous.
Yes.
And I didn't have time to get it tailored before I went, so I needed it cutting down. I needed tailoring anyway. So I went into one of those little shops on Camp Bastion, and I've given the guy my jungle hat, and they all spoke English, like really good English. And I've said what I needed to do, and I paid him, and he said, oh, it'll only take like 10, 15 minutes. So I was like, I'll just wait in the shop. So I'm just sat in this chair, and I don't know what on earth possessed him to say it, because I'd hardly said anything to the guy. But he turns around, he says, some along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing, are you leaving here or are you staying at Back Camp Bastion? And I said, no, I'm flying out to a FOB. I didn't tell him what FOB, but it was FOB Price where I flew out to. And so I said, no, I'm flying out in a couple of days. And he said, right, okay. He was like, if you see lights in the mountains, don't follow them. And I said, what lights? And he said, if you see any balls of light, any lights in the mountains that are going in and out the mountains, he was like, don't follow them. You go missing. Don't come back. And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah. He explained that the white ones, the white orbs, they believed were loved ones who'd passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming back to tell them they're okay. But he said that the purple ones and the blue ones were the jinn.
And
the jinn would take you into the mountains, and people had followed these blue and purple lights over the years, and they'd went missing and they'd never been found. So when he told me that, I was like, obviously I'm into this type of savannah. So as soon as he told me, I'm like, right, I am following nothing. If I see anything, I am following nothing. As it turns out, mate, I flew to a couple of days later, mate, I flew to FOB Price. Because I was firing missiles, I never left FOB Price. So it wasn't a problem for me. I stayed inside the wire all the time. But when you were on the launcher, and every day you'd have to do like calibration checks.
Yeah.
And set the thing up. You could, a couple of times, mate, lads would see the lights in the mountains, going in and out the mountains, these blue and purple lights. And a couple of times I said to them, don't be following them lights. The guy, the Afghani guy and thingy told me that you, and they were like, shut up, man. And I'm like, I'm telling you, that's what he said. And if I was you, I wouldn't follow the lights. And so like I said, mate, that was the first thing that happened. And then off the back of that, we were in the launcher one day, and so the missile mate I was firing at the time was classified as secret,
mm-hmm.
and we were the only nation that had it. Even the Americans mate didn't have it. And so what would happen was, mate, if you got a fire mission, they would send out coordinates, and it was called a deconfliction zone.
Yeah.
So it's like a big, huge, invisible tunnel, which is the direction of the missiles going to go.
Yes.
And all the aircraft get that, so the aircraft don't fly into it. Because obviously you don't want to take your own vehicle out with a missile.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're laid on this fire mission, mate, and so the launcher, mate, had a hatch at the back that you would close, and it had one directly above me that you would close. And then on the top of the mate, had a turret and had six pods. You could fit six missiles in. And so the back hatch, mate's closed, and right before you fire, because obviously it was like 50 degrees, you would leave the top hatch open, and right before you fired, you would close that just to get a bit of airflow in.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty much, mate, to my 1 o'clock, pretty much directly above me.
Mm.
And as I'm doing stuff on the system here, getting ready to fire, the lad who was next to me said, Andy, what's that above us? And as I'm doing that, I say, what's what? And he said, there's some weird aircraft above us. And I'm like, there can't be anything there. And I'm saying deconfliction, that type of thing. And he's like, well, there's something directly above us. What's that then? And so there was no noise, Paul, nothing at all. And I was like, there can't be an aircraft because I can't hear anything. And then he's like, well, what? Have a look then through the hatch. What's that? And I looked up, mate, directly above us was a silver orb, like a perfect sphere. That was, and I always said, mate, judging how far it was away, it looked to maybe be the size of like an old Nissan Micra.
Yeah.
That's how big it was.
Mm.
So it was a decent size. It was a big old orb. And it was just stationary, not moving at all. Just solely stationary above us. And the DC got on the radio, said there's something deconfliction zone. All the checks come back. Nope, there's nothing there. You can fire. And we're not picking anything up. And I'll say, well, if they take a step out the tent and just look up, we'll see that there's something there.
Yeah.
And they were like, nah, nothing there on any of the equipment. Nothing's registering. Fire the missile. So to arm the missile, mate, you had like a plug with like 10 pins on.
Yes.
And you would push it up and then lock it in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would hit what, and then so those six buttons, and then you would hit whatever one you wanted to arm.
Yeah.
So I plugged that in. And then as soon as I've pressed the button to arm the missile, it's then went poof and shot off, mate, at like blink of an eye speed. So it clearly knew the missile wasn't armed, clearly knew because it was there. And then the second that the missile was armed, that's when it took off, blink of light and gone. And obviously we shut the hatch and then fired the missile away to the target.
Was that a common occurrence? Were people saying similar things, Andy? Did you hear anybody else see something?
Never ever heard anyone else, mate, say they'd saw anything else. But to be fair, mate, out of all the things that I spoke about, UFOs, mate, was the one thing nobody wanted to talk about, weirdly. You know what I mean? People had put up talking about ghosts, shadow figures, weird orbs of light. You talk about UFOs, mate, nobody wanted to know. It was just a conversation, mate, nobody was willing to have. Now, whether that's a case of people had seen stuff and they've been told, for your career, you don't talk about it, you keep quiet. To be fair, Paul, that was... I didn't speak about that until, like I say, until I went on Paul's channel.
Yeah.
And weirdly, mate, randomly, that happened, and then the tour kind of really did kick on, and we got maybe 13 or 14 missions, I think, altogether.
Yeah.
In a wanna. So as soon as that happened, mate, that kind of gets forgotten because you've got, like I say, 14 fight missions on the go, and everything's pretty hectic. It wasn't until maybe. Early last year, or the back end of last year, the lad who saw it, who was man number three, randomly messaged me and said, do you remember that thing we saw in Afghan? And I was like, what, the weird orbs light? And he was like, yeah, not just them. He was like, the UFO thing. And it wasn't until he said it to me, I was like, holy, I'd totally forgotten about that.
Yeah.
And he was watching something, mate, on... you know that story come out of the Mosul orb, I think it was called.
Yes, yes,
where
I know
was
exactly
that thing
what you
going
mean.
Through Iraq. So he'd seen that and said, "Holy, we saw that 3 years before that was a video."
Mm.
So that was, I think, that was 2016, and we were obviously 2013. He was like, "Holy, we saw that 3 years before this video was taken.
Yeah.
And that literally was me. What we saw was the Morse Law. I mean, that's what it looked like. It might not have been that specific one.
Yeah.
And like I said, man, that kind of rounded off. That was the only thing that I hadn't seen was a UFO, really.
And that
kind of rounded off. To be fair, mate, I've never seen a cryptid, and yeah. I've never seen a big cat. I've never seen anything like that, which is weird, mate, because that's probably the thing that fascinates me the most.
Yeah.
So the one thing I did want to see, I've never seen. But that kind of rounded off my experiences. And off the back of that, mate, that rounded it off. And then off the back of that, mate, I then found out that there was, like we were talking about earlier, there was the Tyneside UFO Society, or UFO Society, was about it started in 1950 and it ran all the way up to 1978. So there's 20 years of almost three decades worth of stuff there. And I found out that was discovered in 2023. I think it was just stored in the archives, and somehow someone found it in 2023. And there's only one gentleman who's been in looking at it, who was writing a book on it. And then, like I say, maybe a month ago, I then decided to delve into the 2-4 stuff. And that's when I then went in and got my hands on the journals, and you have to put a special access form in, and they're kept in a strong room and all that type of stuff. And then, so I've done a couple of videos on that, mate, because obviously those stories have been lost for maybe, 60 years?
Yeah.
That probably never been told. And it seems, mate, off the back of that, there was two or three groups in the Northeast at any one time. So they had the 2-4 one, and then they also, mate, had the Teesside one where I was from. So they actually had the Teesside UFO Research Group. That was another one that seems to be run alongside of them.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find, I've put some feelers out, mate, to people who could potentially be relatives of the guy who ran the Teesside one.
Yeah.
Because as far as I know, all those files, mate, have never been found. Or maybe someone has them in the attic. Maybe somebody's granddad left them. You know what I mean? And somebody's got them in an attic somewhere.
Yeah.
And that kind of pushed me then, mate, into the research side, I suppose, and then starting my own channel, that type of stuff. And that's how I end up going to Bempton, off the back of it.
Yeah. I bet you couldn't believe your luck when you discovered all the 2-4 stuff, though. I mean, that you must have been rubbing your hands, Andy.
Oh, you know what it is, mate? I can remember going to the library, and like I said, two women who worked in the library said that they didn't have them and they didn't know what I was talking about. And to be fair, mate, I don't think there's anything secretive in that. I just generally think that they didn't know anything about UFOs and they had no interest. Yeah. So why would you know? It wasn't until I went to the 6th floor to like the local archives and I managed to get my hands on them. And to be fair, mate, when they came out, the stuff that brought me out first of all was like professional stuff in like purple hardback books.
Yes.
I brought all those out first and I was looking through them and I said, and it was pretty much, mate, old collections of old, you know, like what's it called? The Flying Saucer Review magazine.
Yes. Yeah,
and that type
of
stuff. So it was just pretty much make collections of them. So I had to go back and say to them, this isn't what I wanted. And they were saying, well, what do you actually want? And I said, well, I want the 2-4 files that the people from Tyneside collected and put together. Yeah. I don't want a magazine. And so then, to be fair, they're really helpful. And they were like, all right, okay. And then so they came out, mate, then with four journals that are pretty thick. I mean, and I think off the top of my head, mate, the first ones they brought out were 54, 56, 58.
Wow.
And I think randomly like 61. And I said to them, can I not start from 78? Because what I wanted to do, Paul, was work from the newest stuff I had.
Yeah.
To try and see if there was anybody still alive that I could talk to.
Yes.
And work my way back over. And they said that when they'd been, because they'd been over to Sweden and stuff was missing, they said that when they stored them back into the strong room, they weren't numerical.
Yeah.
They were all over the shop.
Right.
So they were just taken off what they were. And I said, look, it's fine. I was over the moon. I don't think I'll just take whatever you've got, to be fair.
Yeah. I'll sort it for you.
So over the course, mate, of the week that I went, I think I went through maybe six of them, maybe 6 to 8.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty jam-packed. And there's stuff from all over the world, mate. There's stuff from New Zealand, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Canada, Russia, all over the world. And at the time, I was thinking, how on earth have they got all this stuff in these journals?
Mm.
And then there's an article, mate, from the local Chronicle from back in the mid-50s, and it says that they had working contacts and links with 15 UFO groups all over the world.
Mm.
So these other UFO groups from all over the world were sending them the reports, and they were sharing reports from, obviously, because there's quite a few from Benwell, Walker, Biker, there's stuff from all over Newcastle.
Yeah.
And they were obviously trading reports with all these different countries all over the world.
Wow.
So that's how all the different stuff ended up in. But like I say, it's called the Tarnside UFO Files, but it's kind of a disservice because there's cryptids in there, there's high strangeness, there's ghosts, there's poltergeists, there's UFOs. So it kind of seems like the Tyneside High Strangeness Society would be a better thing for it. But I suppose maybe their main focus was UFOs, but they're just happy to take reports from anything. They were happy to take anything.
Mm. Which I suppose is even better, because it's often been a bone of contention for me, Andy, and obviously you're very similar in this, that I like all kinds of aspects of the weird. So I like hauntings, yeah. I like UFOs, I like cryptids, I like high strangeness. Mm. For me, I find them all equally interesting. And so for you to think, oh, well, I'm just going to get some UFO stuff to find these nuggets of other weird things inside is even better, because often you would get people say, oh, well, I've not seen a UFO, but I've seen this strange thing. And they may go, well, we're not interested in that, sorry. You'll have to find the Tyneside Ghost Club or something, you know? But they haven't. They've accepted that, which was quite odd. I remember once speaking to Philip Mantle, who obviously did a lot of work with Bufora and working in some of the early UFO cases. And he once told me this story where they'd gone to a village out in the moors, Yorkshire moors, about a UFO sighting, and they weren't sure which house this witness lived at. And it was like one of those villages in moors where it's just a street, Andy. That's it.
Yeah.
And then you passed it, you're off. You're on your way to Pickering or somewhere like that. And so he was knocking on doors, and somebody said, open the door. And he said, oh, yeah, we're here about the weird sighting. And so this person said to him, oh, are you here about the black dog? And he went, no. No, we're not. He said, oh, well, the black dog that runs around up and down here with the burning red eyes, you're not here about that? And he's like, no, I'm not. I'm here about this UFO. Oh, the UFO, yeah, he's three doors up. Yeah, fine. So you're not here about the black dog? No. And he was like, what? What is going on here? We've come to find a UFO, and now they're telling us they've got a shuck here. What's happening? So you never know what might fall in your path. Like I said, he was just randomly knocking on doors because he didn't know where this witness was, and ends up coming back with another experience with completely unrelated to it.
Extra value meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Well, that was it when I, like I say, mate, because like I say, it's deceiving that it's called the Tarnside UFO Society. Mm. So I was happy to get my hands on it because I thought, I'm going to get a ton of sightings here from 60 years ago that hardly anyone's heard about for the past 60 years.
Yeah. They've
been lost in time type thing. And then I'm sure, mate, maybe the third page, there was a sighting from, I think if memory serves, it was some type of sea monster from Saskatchewan, I think, in Canada, or Lake Monster. And I was like, what? So then I'm reading it and I'm thinking, why on earth? I was over the moon, it was in there.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, why on earth is this in here? And then it went back to UFOs, and I'm reading then the next case, mate, was a strange case from County Durham. And it was a case of a poltergeist. They were saying that a poltergeist was in this house in County Durham, and it was smashing loads of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then it allegedly had left the house, and it ran down the road, and it smashed maybe 10 car windows. And the police were called, and there was a big investigation of what had caused this thing. And several of these people in this house were adamant this poltergeist had run out and smashed his car windows. So then I was like, well, I've got, in the first 10 pages, I've got cryptids, UFOs, and poltergeists. So I was like, what else is in here? And like I say, mate, that was when, to be fair, mate, if they'd let me, I would have happily stayed in there in the library all night if they'd locked me in. I would have just stayed there, mate, and I would have just been taking all the stuff in from the journals. Crazy, mate, some of the stuff in there, mate, fascinating.
Well, we know it's there now. And I think sometimes these things fall into your lap, Andy, that perhaps often when we get involved in the weird, occasionally, somebody ends up becoming accidentally a custodian of knowledge somehow.
Mm.
And clearly, this is what's happened to you for this, because
yeah,
that's been sat there. Nobody's probably looked at it, like you say, for the best part of 50 years. There's probably cases in there that people have been looking for evidence. Obviously, that particular period as well. You never know. You might stumble across something to do with the Hexham Heads, which is obviously another famous case from your neck of the woods, which has always fascinated me. Because you never know when stuff turns up. Because the BBC rediscovered that documentary they did 50 years ago that had been lost forever. And they found it last year just doing an AI audit and realised that they'd got the film, but the audio had been added to the wrong digitized copy.
Yeah, wrong file, yeah.
And so they've switched it around. Now we've got it back. So you never know what other gems might be hiding in there. But I love stuff like that. But I suppose as well, like you were saying, it probably gives you a good starting point that once you've managed to have a look through as much as possible, you can start to find where your hotspots are in the local area for you to kind of see, have I got something still going on here? Are people still seeing these strange things? How long did it happen for? Why? What else was going on here? And so, yeah, you're on the cusp, I would imagine. You'd be like a kid in a sweet shop, Andy.
Oh, definitely, mate, yeah. I mean, originally, Paul, yeah, that's what I wanted. I wanted it so I could say, right, over the course of, 10 years, there was, say, off the top of my head, 50 sightings in Northumberland, and they're all concentrated in, say, Alnwick, for example.
Yeah.
And that would give me some form of somewhere to go. You know, like Paul does down in Bempton, it would give me a hotspot to go and investigate myself. I mean, it was even, I remember there was a little one in there that sticks to my mind as well. So my dad is originally from Stokesley.
Yeah.
And and that's where my gran was from, who had the haunted wardrobe.
Yes.
And so my dad was born, mate, in 54. And there was an article in there from Stokesley, and he only would have been 3 when it happened. But it says in the article that there was quite a few residents in Stokesley who had witnessed this this UFO, and it had done some spectacular stuff in the sky. And it had been reported by quite a number of credible people, including a policeman in Stokesley. And I said to my dad, how much did my gran see? Because she died when I was 7 going on 8. And how much stuff's been lost that I never, ever knew. Because to be fair, Paul, I think there's a high chance that my gran might have been one of the people who saw the UFO.
Yeah.
You never know, do you?
No.
She lived in Stokesley. She would have been then, in her 20s.
Yeah.
And if she didn't, Stokesley back then, Paul, would have been tiny.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been maybe 50 people. Mm. So if she hadn't saw it, she would have known someone, or likelihood spoke to someone who had seen it, you know?
Yeah. Especially if they knew she had that interest.
Yeah, exactly, mate, yeah. So there's, like I say, mate, it's unbelievable to go in there to see all that stuff from like I say, 60 years ago that's been lost.
Yeah.
And like I say, mate, every time you flip the page, your eyes are all over scanning, trying to take in as much you can, because I'm trying to get through as many journals as I can in a day and taking photos and trying to digest what's on this page. Because, I mean, even in there as well, Paul, there's stuff about, there's a lot of stuff in there about natural disasters.
Mm.
Now, in those journals, Paul, they never ever, to the credit, in there, they never ever put their own opinion across.
Yeah.
So there's nothing in there that says, we think it's true, we don't believe them, and we found this, we think this is the cause. Never, it's just all pretty much factual, citing-based stuff. So all the stuff in there about natural disasters, I don't know what they're in there for, whether they thought that there was some connection or some correlation between UFOs and natural disasters.
Because
there's an awful lot of stuff in there back in the 50s, from floods to volcanoes, landslides. There's all sorts of stuff in there that, to be fair, it happens in hotspots.
Mm.
So it happens in a lot of locations where UFOs are seen. But I don't know whether they just thought it was a synchronicity or it was something.
Yeah.
You know, whether they did think it was linked, but they've never put anything down on paper what their thoughts were.
Intriguing. Well, I've got something for you. Anyway, this might whet your appetite. So I was up in Alnwick in April. Because as I said to you, you know, I'm not just telling you I like Northumberland. I go there and visit it. I enjoy it. I love it. I've been it all. Like, my partner lived on Lindisfarne for a bit on Holy Island and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so we came up at Easter and we were based in Alnwick because I'd never been to Berwick. So I wanted to visit Berwick, but also I wanted to go to Lindisfarne. She wanted to take me to Lindisfarne because she's still got family there, Andy. Yeah. And also finally visit Chillingham because I've never been to Chillingham either.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I was, you know, killing as many birds with one stone. So we were there Thursday night. We'd been out. We got some fish and chips, and we got this beautiful B&B on the beach at Alnwick, just before you get to the harbour. That, yeah, obviously opposite sides Berwick. It's smack next door, isn't it? Near enough. And so we sat there, and we got this beautiful, massive, big bay window. We got these two beautiful reclining chairs. So we sat there. Just watching the sea. I'd got a ship app on my phone, Andy. I would say, right, where's that ship going? Where's it been? So we were just chilling out, you know what I mean? Beautiful, listening to the sea. Fabulous. And we're looking at the stars because, you know, once you speak to Paul Sinclair, you never look at the sky the same, I'd say. And so we obviously sat there, and I've seen one definite thing in my life. Ironically, 15 years ago this week, strangely. So.
All right.
So we're sat there and we're talking about stuff and we're watching it. We're looking at the sky and beautiful. Stars are shining. Beautiful. There's a bit of fluffy cloud, but mostly clear. And then all of a sudden, I'm thinking, hang on a minute, what's going on here? And there's this ball of light just starts shooting under the stars. And at first I thought, is that a plane? Plane tracker out? No. Satellite tracker out? No. And then as I'm thinking, I wonder what that is. It just goes and dropped, just dropped straight down and then carried on for a bit. And I said, Julie, we've got a UFO. Grab your phone. So she ran round to grab her phone. And by the time she'd come back, it just went pop, vanished. Didn't go behind a cloud. Didn't switch off. It just popped out, gone. And that was in April.
You know what's crazy about that, mate, is I was up in Berwick, mate, in June, and I went to Lindisfarne as well. I went to Holy Island,
yeah,
because it was my birthday in June, and we were staying out in the middle of nowhere near Berwick for that very reason, to try and see something. Totally forgot that in the middle of June it doesn't get dark till about 11:30 at night.
Sat there on solstice, going, hang on a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah, it was a bit, yeah. So bless me, Leanne, mate, are up at 11:30 at night.
Yeah.
It finally starts to get dark.
Yeah.
And then all these clouds, mate, roll in.
Oh.
And I couldn't see a thing.
Mm.
But to be fair, mate, that spurred me on, now that you've seen that up there.
Definitely. Weren't looking for it. We were just sat there, chilling out. Yeah. Just because I love to sit outside if it's nice or be able to. Yeah. And just look at the sky. I love it. I don't understand why people aren't fascinated by just looking at the night sky, Andy. I just find it incredible. And so it was because it started acting weird, the way it flew, that clicked straight away. I went, yeah. Checked all my apps. It's not a plane. It's not a drone. It's not a satellite. It's clearly not a ship because I've got my ships and they're down here. It's not there. It's not that. But it was, and I had to chuckle. This is the thing, you get used to this. Because as soon as I said to Julie, my partner, grab your phone, come on, let's record it. As soon as I said that, bang, gone.
Yeah.
Like bang. It knew what we were doing. But yeah, that was Thursday before Easter. That was about 8:00 at night.
Mm. It's definitely a place up there, mate. It's definitely got a good feel up there.
Absolutely. And you've got very little light pollution as well. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you don't have to come far inland either, Andy, do you? A couple of miles and it's just farms, really.
That's where we stay, mate. We literally were staying on a farm, just in like one of these things, you know, like I think they call it a shepherd's hut, like a little cabin.
Mm.
And that's what we were staying in.
Mm.
But like I said, it was 11:30 at night before it got dark and the clouds rolled in.
Yeah.
So it was no go for us. But
You'll be one of the few people cheering at the end of October then when clocks go back.
Oh, mate, I've been so happy. I've been praying. It's my honestly, mate, my favourite time of year. Couldn't wait for the Dark Knights to come rolling in.
Oh, well, excellent. Well, keep us informed, and I'd love to hear more about this.
Yeah, definitely, mate.
These files you've discovered down the line at some point, because obviously you mentioned the magic word for me, which is poltergeist, because I love poltergeist cases. Absolutely.
All right, okay.
I'll have to pick your brains and chew the fat over some of them sometime, my
friend.
Mate,
I'm definitely happy to come back on, mate, and talk about the 2-4 files.
Yeah.
In more depth, some of the cases and that in there.
Hey, well, listen, first of all, thank you so much for your honesty and your candidacy and sharing some of your experiences and your stories and your interests with us today, Andy. Where can everybody find your channel? Keep up to date with what's going on. And what have you got planned for later in the year with that channel?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, mate. I appreciate it. I've seen you on Paul's channel, so I thought I'd take a risk and see if you'd have me on. So thank you very much.
See, I am as nice as I appear.
So the YouTube channel is Andy H, Shadows and Sightings on YouTube. And my email address, mate, is shadowsandsightings3010@gmail.com. If anybody wants to send sightings or anything in, or drop me a message.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also got a Discord server set up. The link's on my YouTube channel as well. So there's loads of people in there, mate, talking about sightings and ghosts and cryptids and you name it.
Brilliant.
And moving forward, mate, for the channel is I've got a lot more stuff on the 2-4 files coming.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do with those videos, mate, is I break them down. So I do stuff that's predominantly, mate, I do UK stuff. And at the beginning, then I move it into the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the videos, mate, usually about half an hour, and I cover maybe 5 or 6 cases and talk through them. And also, mate, off the back of that, I've got, so I do the UFO stuff and the high strangeness stuff. And then separately, mate, I do cryptid stuff separately because
mm-hmm.
quite a few cryptid reports. So I've got the 2-4 files, which is UFO, high strangeness. And then I've got the cryptid cases, which is separate. Because there's quite a few of them as well. And in that as well, mate, is included big cats as well. I've included the big cats phenomena in there.
Fantastic.
And then moving forward, mate, what I want to do is go out to, so the stuff that's local, Paul, so the Newcastle, Northumberland stuff, because back in the day, they were quite trusting and they put addresses down and stuff where it actually happened.
Yeah.
So my plan is, mate, to actually go to the places that it happened and do the reports from there.
Yeah.
So you can see the direction it was travelling, what it would look like in the sky, and that type of stuff, so people get a bit more of a feel for where the stuff actually happened. So that's my plan moving forward.
Brilliant. Well, I wish you the best of luck. I'll keep my eye on it.
Thank you very much,
mate. Look forward to your next reports. I'll put links to everything in my show notes for people to track you down and look at your previous videos and keep an eye on them and hopefully get you a few subscribers on that channel, my friend. And I just want to say thanks again for your time. It's been brilliant to speak to you properly for the first time, Andy, and hear some of your experiences. A couple have creeped me out a bit more than I expected on a dark night. Here we are at the end of September. And I wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we'll speak again. And all the best to you and the channel going forwards.
Thank you very much, mate. Thanks for having me on, and I hope everyone enjoyed it.